from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in our opening hour this morning, for the first time, Google is opening up the sale of its controversial Google Glass to the general public. The device resembles a pair of eyeglasses and lets users surf the internet and take photos and videos. As wearable technologies become more common, critics are raising privacy and safety concerns. How will an increased use of such technology shape our lives and test our ethics? It's all coming up next. After this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Tomorrow is tax day, but it's also the day Google has decided to open up sales to the public of its controversial Google Glass. That's a wearable computer with the same features as a mobile phone, but you put it on your head. We're going to look in this morning's opening Forum hour at the pros and cons of Google Glass and the future of what has come to be called wearable computing. Joining us for the hour here in studio is Matt Honan. He's a senior writer for Wired and wrote a piece for Wired on his own experiences wearing Google Glass. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. We also have Thad Starner with us. He's with us from Atlanta this morning. He's professor of computing at Georgia Tech and advisor on Google's Project Glass. Welcome, Thad Starner.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Robert Gell, who joins us this morning from Salt Lake City, Utah. He's assistant professor of communications at the University of Utah and author of the forthcoming book, Reverse Engineering Social Media. Welcome, Robert Gell.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. I'm going to begin with Matt Honan here in studio, who I guess had some ambivalent feelings about this. But for the most part, what I took away from your article, which I read with real interest, was maybe more novelty than utility.
Well, I think at this point that's fair. I think that right now a lot of what Glass does is pretty basic. And I think that, you know, until you start seeing a lot more software on there, which is slowly coming, it's going to be doing, you know, very basic things that you might see that you might take you a second or two to do on your smartphone.
Yeah, well, what does it offer that the mobile phone doesn't offer? I mean, I think you said in your article it made you hate your phone.
Well, I do like the concept of being able to, you know, just see things at a glance without having to pull a device out of your pocket. I think that the you know, the culture that we've gotten into, we're in the habit of just staring at our phones all the time, isn't really healthy. It's not really a good place for society to be, where we're so focused on our devices instead of the other people around us. And I think it does help you get tidbits of information, get in and get out, and do something with those tidbits of information without sort of getting sucked into that screen. It's really easy when you're staring at that screen to, like, you know, fire off an email and then go and look at Twitter and then go and look at the web and then go do something else. Whereas with the Glass, you tend to kind of do something, stop doing it, go on about your business.
Well, on the other hand, if you're driving and using Glass, it can not only distract you, but make your eyes tired, all kinds of effects like that.
Sure. Well, I would also hope that you wouldn't be driving and using Glass or your smartphone, really, you know, unless you're just using the audible GPS functions or something like that. But it's, you know, I think one of the things about Glass is there are situations where it's clear that you shouldn't use it, and driving is one of them.
What about with a second child that's being born? That's when you used it, right? Well, Your wife wasn't too happy about it.
I didn't end up using it. I wanted to use it when our second child is being delivered and things happened very quickly. We wound up leaving for the hospital a lot faster than we didn't have as much time as I had anticipated and wasn't packed. So, but I wanted to wear Glass in the delivery room. I did. And my wife certainly wasn't, you know, too hot on that idea. She thought it would be kind of weird or off-putting. And the way I looked at it, though, is, again, it's sort of like that smartphone idea, you know, being trapped behind that screen and sort of staring at the smartphone instead of looking at the thing that's going on in your life. I think it's very powerful. I think it's one of the more useful things that Glass does.
Just for clarity, you were going to use it to record the birth of your son.
I was, yes, I was. And I one of the things that it could have done that I was thinking about doing was, you know, being able to bring the children's grandparents into the room, because our parents, my wife's parents and my parents, both live all the way across the country. They couldn't be there. But, you know, you can do things like have these hangouts, which are basically video chats, where people see what you're seeing. And I thought it would be a really wonderful way for the grandparents to, if not during the actual, you know, childbirth itself, maybe immediately afterwards or something like that, to be present in the room.
We're talking to Matt Honan, by the way, who's here with us in studio, and he's senior writer for Wired, or wrote a piece for Wired on his experiences wearing Google Glass. You were kind of conscious, to put it mildly, of the class divide in wearing Google Glass. I mean, the fact is, there's what we call the creepy factor, and people who look at those wearing Google Glass, and there are a number of instances we'll talk about in the course of the hour, where people feel you're kind of in a special status compared to us.
I think that's true, you know, and I think that's probably even more so true here in San Francisco than a lot of other places because of everything going on with, you know,
the buses and the
buses and the housing costs. And but I was very conscious of it. You know, I mean, you're wearing a $1,500 device on your face, you know, and not only that, I mean, until tomorrow, you're wearing a device that not everybody can have access to. When I initially got it, it was relatively early in the program. It was really early in the program. And there were only, you know, I don't know how many, but a couple thousand or so at tops people who had it. And, you know, you do feel a little bit like you're in a sort of an elite company, even if you don't want to be an elite when you're wearing this thing. And you notice people notice you wear it. You can't help but not notice. If you're not noticing people noticing you wearing it, you're not very observant. And, you know, I became very conscious of wearing it in certain situations, and I pretty quickly sussed out a lot of situations that I wouldn't wear it in.
I actually tried them at an event for the Tipping Point, you know, the group that raises money particularly for poverty and so forth. There were a lot of people from Silicon Valley there, and they, you know, try them on. But those, I mean, that group of people seemed very comfortable with them, as opposed to going into a bar, going into a place that's public. The fact is, though, let's talk with you a little bit, and then we'll talk with our two professors about just general acceptance. There seems to be now use of these in law enforcement, in manufacturing, and athletics, as you point out. But maybe Chris Curran says technology looking for problems to solve. And on the consumer level, excuse me, it's entirely different at this point, isn't it? Because that's where it's going to open tomorrow.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, that's fair. I think it's looking for problems to solve that don't necessarily exist yet. I think that there's a lot of pressure on technology companies to have a great wearable out. You know, I mean, you see people like pressuring Apple all the time. Where's your iWatch? Where's your iWatch? You know, and everybody's getting into this. All the big players are getting into wearables because it is where we're going. And this is definitely something that's going to happen. But in terms of Google Glass, you know, in particular, this device, it's got some really basic functions that most people aren't going to use a whole lot. There's some great stuff on there, like that, where, you know, it's location aware, so it can tell you, you know, it can pop up these Google Now alerts based on stuff that you're doing. Hey, it's time for you to leave for work, or it's time for you to, you know, leave for forum, because it knows where you are, it knows what your calendar is, it knows where your meetings are, and it can tell you that kind of stuff really serendipitously. But that's, you know, I mean, that's not a huge societal problem that we have. It's not like that's really solving, you know, some huge issue. There are other things it can do, though, that are very cool, and I think once people experience those, like being able to look at a sign and it translates that sign. Now, eventually, you're going to be able to do something like that with a device that doesn't cost $1,500, the device that may cost $200 for the plan or $50 for the plan, you know, some sort of data plan, just like your smartphone. And that's going to be when these things get really interesting.
Well, it is being used in solar power technicians by solar power technicians in Southern California. It's being used in healthcare. I mean, I guess one of the real questions looming over this is, what about the consumers? And Thad Starner is a professor of computing at Georgia Tech and advisor on Google's Project Glass. He's with us from Atlanta, and you've been wearing them a lot, and you seem very bullish on them. What about for the consumer? What about daily wear?
Well, I've been wearing wearable computers as part of my daily life for the past 21 years. I've been making many systems over the years, and one of the things I've been looking at is why you want to wear one of these things. And in response to Matt's comment, you know, with tablet PCs have just overtaken laptops in sales in Europe. There's more tablets sold than laptops. And you would argue they don't actually create new, they're not doing anything that laptops can't do or smartphones can't do. But the difference about glasses, it's the first technology that's actually built for a person. It's really built to be part of your life. It's built it's not built around the possibilities of current technology. In the past, our mainframes and our PCs and our laptops have all been built around the screen and what was possible. Here, what we're trying to do is make a system that provides you the support you need when you need it and then gets out of your way. To put some numbers on that, just to take out your smartphone right now, unlock it, and get to the stage where you can send an SMS to somebody, it takes 23 seconds on average. I mean, I've timed this. I've actually done this as a study. With Glass, it takes less than 2 seconds. and that changes the way you use these devices.
So it's faster. But I'm wondering, since you're throwing out some numbers here, about your response to a study that was done by Telura Data, they're a collection firm, and market research. 72% of people who were asked in this study said they'd avoided, that is, buying Google Glass out of concerns for privacy.
Well, if you go look at cell phones, you have the same numbers back then. People said, well, I'd never buy a cell phone, or I'd only buy it for 911. What happens is people get it, and they think they're going to have it for 911, and they eventually realize that what they really use it for is SMSing family over distances. And so a lot of what happens is when people finally get a device, finally get to use it, get a first-person demo, their perceptions of it change dramatically. You don't really see how it's going to work with your life until you've played with it a bit. I think we're going to see the same thing with this device. We saw the same thing with smartphones. We saw the same thing with telephones. We saw the same cell phones in the first place. And matter of fact, 100 years ago, we saw the same thing with the telephone in the house.
Do you have any thoughts, though, Professor Steiner, about this class divide? You know, they're even using the word glassholes about people who wear Google Glass. I don't know if you've had any of that kind of enmity thrown at you, but the sense that, people are maybe getting glassed out or zombie-ish or, you know, all the sorts of things you hear that separate those who wear Google Glass.
Well, that's precisely what we're trying not to do with attention. But, you know, if you think about people looking down at their cell phones during the day, they're really distracted by the technology. Glass is the first technology that allows you to look up and engage in the world around you. We're concentrating on making things called micro-interactions, where, you know, if somebody sends you an SMS, you get a little bing in your ear, and you can choose to ignore it, right? It doesn't bother you. Just know there's something there. If you have a second, you can glance up, see the SMS, and then nod your head and send it away again if it's not interesting. But if it is interesting, you can say, okay, Glass, reply. Please talk to Cynthia. She will actually get you the account for that purchase. You know, this is something that happens with my students all the time. It's something that allows you to get in and out of the interaction so quickly that it really is not that interruption that mobile phone is, not that 23 seconds just to get your phone unlocked. As far as, you know, interactions around here, I live in Atlanta. I just went to something called the Dogwood Festival, which is 300,000 people going to artist booths and music festivals, and I had not one bad interaction. Matter of fact, even artists who, you know, had things that said no photography in their booths, you know, they wanted demos. They were very excited about Glass and very curious and saw the uses for it. So, in Atlanta, people are curious and excited about the device.
Is it worth $1,500, I suppose, is the big question many people are asking. And maybe, to quote Matt Honan from his article in Wired, he says, maybe right now there's a lot of excitement, not so much about where it's going as about, well, less is about where it is at present. In other words, I think I'm quoting him when he says the future is on the way and it's in your face.
Well, I think one of the things is you have to figure out what you're going to use it for. Certainly the man whose life was just saved by Glass would argue that that's worth $1,500. I don't know if you've seen this, but Beth Israel Hospital in Boston, one of the doctors there credits Glass for actually saving his patient's life because he could look up something quickly. We're working on an application here called captioning on Glass, which allows people who are hard of hearing, which is, you know, people as they age, they tend to lose their hearing. It allows you to hand the person you're trying to talk to your cell phone, and they tap on the cell phone and say what they want to say. It transcribes that and then puts it on Glass. And why that's important is that it allows you to keep your attention on the other person's lips and facial gestures, so you get most of the conversation already just from normal conversational cues. But it also allows you to look up for that word or two that you missed in that conversation. We've also done something called translation on Glass, where if you're traveling and you need to speak somebody in Spanish, you hand them your cell phone. They speak in Spanish. You speak in English. You speak in English. They see it on Spanish on their cell phone, or on your cell phone, rather. So it really allows you to do a lot of great stuff in these situations. We have another explorer who's actually been making glass for people who are blind. This is something where, you know, suppose you're blind and you live alone, and somebody gave you, say, a box of food for Christmas, and you're allergic to nuts. You know, how do you figure out whether or not you can eat the contents of this box. Well, normally, you wouldn't bother going to your neighbor and asking for help because that's just too much trouble. Well, what this guy has done, his name is Brandon White, he's at the University of Maryland, he works with a guy by the name of Jeff Bingham at CMU. What they've done is made a system where you can take a picture of that container and then send it to something called Amazon Mechanical Turk, which is lots of people doing small tasks for small amounts of money. And so you can send this picture saying, okay, Glass, take a picture, share with Ware Script. It sends the picture off to these people, and you can say, does this box contain nuts? And within about 30 seconds or so, comes back the answer. You can actually use Glass while you're in the process of cooking. It actually works with what you're doing. The other thing we've been seeing is, my personal pet peeve is people who live through their viewfinder when they're out on vacation or when they're going to their child's music recital. If you sit in one of these music recitals, you see all these people living through their viewfinder. They have their tablet or their camcorder or their smartphone up, and they're all worried about framing their kid's recital as opposed to living in the moment. With something like Glass, you turn it on, and then it's doing that. It's getting what you see, and you can live in the moment. It gets the technology out of your way. And for me, that's priceless.
Well, you've given us a lot of the pluses of uses of Glass. And again, Thad Stern is professor of computing. He's an advisor on Google's Project Glass. And there are a lot of those. I'm not in the role of cheerleader here, but, you find about work with deaf children and with Braille and piano playing and with service dogs.
For me, the big thing is simply the simplest things is what really is life-changing for me, SMS and email. It sounds boring, I know. But for me, that's what I use all the time. I use it every day for that. I've used it right now, getting ready, prepared for this conversation. I was having trouble getting online with your team, and I was doing SMSs back and forth, and I was right to my eyeball. It was very fast. I could reply with speech much faster than I could ever do on my smartphone. And it's those small things that you do time and time again, say 50 times a day. 50 times a day, if you're checking for an SMS and taking 23 seconds to do so, you're literally wasting hours of your day just trying to get to the point where you can start doing work.
All right, I want to bring Robert Gellin because he is not so sanguine about the use of Google Glass. He's assistant professor of communications, University of Utah, author of a forthcoming book called Reverse Engineering Social Media. And before we hear from him, we had asked listeners on social media to just complete the sentence, Google Glass is, and here's a sample of some of the responses we've received. Elizabeth, creepy. Joe, overly intrusive, arrogant, and overpriced toy. I don't usually judge a book by its cover, but when I see someone walking toward me in public with a pair on, I've always drawn a conclusion about the individual wearing them. Katie says, Google Glass is too expensive for me, and Stephen writes, Google Glass is inevitable. So let's go to you, Robert Gell. I mean, your main concern, I would imagine, is with privacy, but I read your article in The Week, and you said this is kind of a mind meld. It's the cyborg future, and it's terrifying.
Yeah, well, one of the things that I would have wanted to challenge about Glass is actually one of the statements they made on their site, Google made, about the myths of Glass. And myth 7, Glass is the perfect surveillance device. And this is something they want to debunk. They say, if a company sought to design a secret spy device, they could do a better job than Glass. And I would say Google's absolutely right. A company that builds a search engine that wants to dominate mobile phones, to be involved in online video, to be involved with us as we use social networking, as we chat, as we email, want to scan every book on the planet, want us to download music from it. Glass is one part of a large surveillance infrastructure that Google's building, and it's articulated with that surveillance infrastructure. Glass by itself is a pretty crummy surveillance device, I grant that. But when you think about it in terms of its centralization and its close ties to this powerful tech company, I think that should give a lot of people pause.
You also gave me a little pause in the article I read that you did where you said that the digitalized site becomes a government memory. Want to clarify what you mean by that?
Well, when we have a situation like Facebook and Google that have so much of our personal information in them and they become centralized, it's very easy for a government to come knocking on the door and say, give us information on X, Y, Z individuals, and by the way, you can't tell them that we're asking about this. And so one of my major concerns here is as we network our very vision with Google, and we network our very vision with Facebook through their purchase of the virtual reality company. We're basically saying, here's a great store of our personal information, and it's a ripe target for government surveillance and government warrants.
You also cite a couple of, episodes that took place. One was the Lost Lake Cafe up in Seattle, which has now become virtually a part of folklore, where somebody was told that he couldn't come in if he was wearing Google Glass. But another one that maybe a lot of people don't know about, that's a theater, a movie theater in Ohio with the Department of Homeland Security involved. And you want to at least give us a rendering of what that was all about?
Yeah, so from what I understand, a patron wearing glass in a movie theater was pulled out of the movie theater by agents from the Department of Homeland Security, ostensibly to see if he was recording the movie. And I find it very interesting that we have a government agency called the Department of Homeland Security so concerned about intellectual property violations. So imagine a situation where you're wearing glass and then you're stopped by someone and say, okay, hand over the device, let me see what you've seen for the past, period of time to see if you've seen anything incriminating or done anything incriminating. Again, that should give us a pause. It's not too dissimilar from cell phones.
That's just not feasible with the current product.
Well, certainly it's not feasible with the current product.
Let's look at the smartphone. People had a lot of the same concerns with camera phones when they came out, and yet you don't see that sort of worry now. It sounds like what you're really worried about is the government getting in there, and fortunately we live in a democracy where we can actually change these things. And, it seems that what we really want here is unreasonable search and seizure, right?
Absolutely.
You want to have rules that say if your smartphone is equivalent to your person, for self-incrimination. And so what I would actually, privacy is one of my big things. I teach privacy at Georgia Tech. My school chair is Annie Anton. She does privacy. Some of my people I talk to are some of the leading privacy experts in the world. And the first conversation I had with Sergey on Glass was on privacy. And so I believe that Glass is an example of being very honest with the user. Unlike any of these other devices, you know when it's on. You know when people are doing stuff with it.
Well, we're coming up on a break here, and I want to just get Robert Gill on record about this. Do you have other concerns about privacy, Robert Gill?
Well, yeah. I'm also concerned about all these companies basically being conduits for our digital lives. I'm not just concerned about government surveillance. I see corporate surveillance as the flip side of it. So all these companies are basically inviting us to have our entire digital lives flow through them. They want to know our thoughts, our fears, our desires. At the core, Google is not a tech firm. It is an advertising firm, and it wants to know more about us in order to channel our desires to specific directions. I find that quite troubling.
All right. I want to find out what you, our listeners, think. There are those who feel that Google Glass is creepy and rude. There are those who feel that it's really leading the way to the future, and you may want to weigh in here about your own reactions. Some think that social acceptance may, be like the acceptance of the Segway. I don't know. What are your feelings about this? Indeed, the future in our face, as Matt Honan had it. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. We do welcome your calls, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Feel free to join the program. Again, it's toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And again, we ask you if you want to post us on Facebook, Google Glass is fill in the blank. Talking with Matt Honan, senior writer for Wired, with Thad Starner, professor of computing at Georgia Tech, and Robert Gell, who's assistant professor of communications at University of Utah. Hear from you when we return on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about Google Glass, and let me just read a few of your emails. Robert writes, two of your guests describe using Google Glasses as a step forward compared to a person constantly bent over and checking their cell phone. This ignores another option, namely not looking at any device constantly, but actually living a healthy, satisfying life without such constant tethers. And Sue writes, what about the significant percentage of the population that wears prescription eyewear? And let me read a few more comments that are coming, like this one online from Robert, who says, Google will sell some of these to enthusiasts. Glass will probably be adapted for elite technical utility, as we've heard about for surgeons and so on. Then they will be used by others who need hands-free data display while working at more prosaic tasks. Then they may be used by others. Glass seems an ideal thing for Wired journalists to write about, and Wired seems an ideal venue for writing about Glass. An hour? Really? Frank writes, Google could not have made Glass any more creepy looking. I understand that they are now working with Ray-Ban to make a less conspicuous version and that a competitor already has such a device, but in the end, recording people in public is creepy and sometimes outrageous. Whether it is done by a dorky geek in a bar or by a peeping Tom or by a TSA body scanner or by the Department of Homeland Security's Trapwire cameras, which are located around San Francisco and can do facial recognition. Whereas in France, it is illegal to take a person's photograph in public without their permission. We Americans could learn something about, or from the French, about human dignity. There are those who say that this is another form of, shall we say, paparazzi. John writes, Google Glass will destroy whatever shreds of privacy we have left, create even more distracted people, and increase violence. And Lee writes, I'm wondering when we'll stop chasing after and celebrating toys for rich boys and girls that promise much but invariably lead us down the technology rabbit hole to more ways to watch cat videos and post twaddle. In the immortal words of Dame Edna, I say this is the most loving and caring way. I can't wait until someone crashes his Tesla because they were distracted by watching a cat make telephone calls. Ah, the perfectly poetic justice. And here's Don, who says, I just looked at the Wikipedia article on Glass. Pretty amazing, though. Using it could certainly be distracting while multitasking, just like driving and texting. The emphasis on taking secret pictures is just typical media pot-stirring. If you search for wearable cameras on Amazon, you can find much more secretive units for a lot less, like $25. And remember that we asked on Facebook listeners to respond to that question, to fill in the blank, Google Glass is, and here are some more of those. Google Glass is a fashion crime, says Adrian. Another listener says, too expensive for something in a testing phase. Elizabeth says, tech for tech's sake, not in what we need to be creating. Kathy tweets, Google Glass is the first step in reengaging with life while still being connected to technology. And Richard writes, Google Glass is a step on the road to us being part of the Borg collective. And let me actually go back to you, Robert Gell, on that idea of the Borg here, the cyborg future that you write about in your article. What terrifies you there?
Well, I'm not too concerned about any specific devices. In fact, I find what that is doing to be quite incredible. I mean, humans use prosthetics for a long time. We wear clothes. We wear eyeglasses. What I'm concerned about is when we network these devices to centralized server farms, when we agree to terms of service to say, I'm going to give you all my private information in exchange for access to this device, and when we pretend that what we're doing with it is socializing with our friends, but what we're really doing is profiling ourselves for marketers, and not only doing that, but setting up a centralized place where governments can come and say, hey, give me all that information on these people. That's what terrifies me, is the centralization, not the devices themselves. I think there's a lot of good we can do with these prosthetic devices.
And what about that, Starner, that question that was raised about people with prescription glasses? Get a comment from you on that?
I believe that there are prescription lenses available for glass.
There are. You can actually get prescription frames now, and you order glass with the device, and I believe we're doing that shortly. And I believe there's third parties out there that are already taking the glass devices that are out there, allowing you to order frames and then getting your lenses put into them. Personally, I wear some of the early versions of the prescription frames, been doing that for about a year now. It's quite comfortable, and I wear glass from the time I get up to the time I go to bed.
And let me bring Matt Honan back in, the senior writer for Wired, and then we'll go to your calls here. Matt, you've heard a lot of this cascading comments, pro and con, everything. Where do you want to weigh in here?
Well, I mean, I think one of the things that people really get hung up on are the privacy issues. And I do think that there's a lot more to think about in terms of what we're doing with our smartphones than there is with these wearable devices right now. I mean, our smartphones are almost always with us, tracking where we are, who we're talking to. If you take pictures with them, if you're using, you know, an Android or an iOS device, more than likely your pictures are automatically being uploaded to the cloud already, the kind of stuff Google Glass is doing. And you know, what Google Glass does is it basically makes the things that your smartphone – it does some of the things your smartphone already does, but not all of them. And when you're, you know, talking about taking a picture with Google Glass or taking a video with Google Glass, as one of your writers or listeners pointed out, you know, there are already just all of these wearable cameras. Earlier on KQED, I heard them talking about the Oakland Police Department all wearing wearable cameras. And we're already entering this surveillance state. And I do think it's something that we should be aware of and we should be conscious of and we should be you know, thinking about as a society, but I don't think that it's something that's particular to glass.
What about when it's called surreptitious surveillance? I mean, that's essentially the language that we hear from Professor Gell. Those cameras are out there.
That's one of the big things about glass we did from the beginning. When you look at privacy, there's six design principles you do for privacy. The first one you always talk about is notice. Are you giving notice to the user, first of all, of what they're doing? But in our case, with glass, are you giving notice to people around you to what you're doing with glass? And the great thing about glass is it lights up whenever you're using it. If you're taking pictures with it, you have to line it up, right? To take a picture with it, we have to either say, okay, glass, take a picture, where you're actually announcing it to the world.
Professor Stern, it's very different than, you know, pointing your mobile phone at someone and taking a shot. You know, you have to do it in a kind of framing way. This can be done much greater alacrity, obviously.
Well, look around KQED Studios. Look at the office you're in. Look at how many cameras are staring at you as you go to the elevator or out on the street.
Yeah, but I know about those cameras. I'm aware of them. If I go out on the street and someone takes a picture with a Google with Google Glass, very different. It could just be done, like I said, like
but
paparazzi.
But you know who actually is seeing that picture with those cameras, those CCTV cameras. With glass, you know who it is who took the picture, and you can address them.
Matt, I want Matt to weigh in here.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I'd actually argue that it's much easier to take a picture of somebody with a cell phone without them knowing about it than it is with Google Glass right now. Like today, because glass is so unusual looking and you have to point your face at somebody to take a picture with it, you know, it's very noticeable. Whereas, you know, I can kind of casually hold my cell phone and look like I'm texting or doing something else and be taking all kinds of pictures. But, you know, when you go forward, Google's done this deal with Luxottica. I'm sure Google's not going to be the only company making, you know, computers that you wear on your face or on your wrists or all over your body. As we go forward, it's going to get easier and easier and easier to do this surreptitious surveillance. And, you know, that's where the problems come in, because people have a right to not be, I think, to not you know, be recorded without their consent.
Well, let me find out what our listeners have to say. I'm going to go to the callers now, actually, and go to Mountain View first. Ann, you're on. Good morning.
Hi. I want to talk turkey about making my life easier with Google Glass, but I have a comment and a question. So, you know, if there was a way for me, as I'm doing my taxes, to look at a receipt and for that receipt to be instantly scanned in and all of that information accurately go where it needs to be in my computing records, you know, so that my receipts are automatically checked against my statements and, you know, not just my taxes are done, but the receipt goes to the warranty file and my scrapbook file. You know, I went to this restaurant at this date and I want to put that in my photo book. I mean, you know, everything instantly. That would make my life a lot easier. In fact, I want to put a bug in your ear for Google to pressure for some kind of standardized little box of information on receipts so that it's very accurate to do that, so that you can physically see the information as a person and have a code so that you can scan it in instantly. You can check it against it with your Google Glass instantly. But now, if I do that, is Google going to get all that information? I mean, is that how it's going to work, or can I do that privately at home?
That's a good question. Matt?
Well, I mean, you can already do sort of some of that with apps like Evernote. So Google Glass isn't just Google software on it. It's got all kinds of third-party developer stuff on there. Some of that's better than others. Like there's a Tumblr app on there that I've never been able to get to work in however many months of trying. But, you know, you could already do that with something like Evernote and scan in a receipt. The other stuff about being able to file it away and whatnot, I would assume that a smart developer out there listening might write something like that.
And there are smart developers who listen, and thank you, Ann, for the call and the question, and we're going to go to another caller. Stephen, that's you. Welcome to Forum.
Hi, good morning. I'm one of those that believe that this is just a classic product searching for a purpose. I don't think I would ever use it, primarily because I'm nearsighted and I wear glasses. And for me to even watch a 3D movie, it's like putting a birdcage on my face. So I find it intrusive, and this is a classic example of a company trying to convince the populace that you have to be connected at every moment of your life, because technology expedites everything, and an algorithm is a solution to everything. And I just don't want to live my life that way. So
I thank you for that call. And there again, Professor Steiner, and I know you'll probably have a reaction to that, technology looking for a problem to solve.
Well, for me, it was exactly the opposite way around. I made my first wearable computer take good notes in class. I found that at MIT, I was actually not retaining the lessons I was getting, and I wanted better ways to take notes in class. So I designed my wearable computer to do better things for face-to-face interactions. I found that when you have these 2-minute discussions with the world's expert on something, you want to retain that, and so I made a good note-taking method to do it. As far as intrusive towards your caller, I'm -5 diopters. I'm also nearsighted, and I wear glass with prescription lenses. It works just fine for me. And frankly, I like not being connected. My students will tell you that I am the least good person on email for somebody who's so connected, in theory, as I am. For me, when I go to Yosemite or to Kings Canyon, I'm using glass to take a picture. When I was looking at a lake in front of me, and a black bear surfaces right in front of me, right? And so I say, okay, glass, record a video as I'm backing away, and my vision is on the black bear, so I don't get eaten. But I know glass is capturing the experience, and that has nothing to do with connecting to the rest of the world. Matter of fact, I find personally that having glass handle my interruptions is much better than what's currently out there with laptops or smartphones. Matter of fact, during this discussion, glass gave me a little bing, and I waited until the break, and I looked up and I found out that my wife said, "Listening, I love you," which was great, and that did not interrupt me because I waited until the right time.
Well, that sounds beyond utility. Robert Gell, when you hear all of this from Thad Starner, what's your reaction just in terms of the utilitarian nature of Google Glass?
Well, I think computers, network technology is phenomenal. It's done incredible things for us and can continue to do so. I'm concerned about it, again, being connected to these large corporations that may not have our best interests at heart. And moreover, I would like to see the ability of people to bend devices to their will as opposed to accept technology as it's designed for them. So one of the things I like to think about is contrasting something like Google Glass with Raspberry Pi, which is a $35 small computer that is obviously accessible because you can buy it for $35, you can program it. People have done a remarkable range of projects with that computer. And if you compare that to Glass's terms of service, you don't even own Glass when you buy it. You're renting it. Right now, there's acknowledgement from Google that they won't brick it if you sell it to somebody else or if you do something with it that they don't approve of. But they could change their mind down the road, and they claim ownership over the device. I think if you don't have the ability to open up your device and modify it, as Thad did when he was taking notes at MIT, you're setting yourself up to be controlled by the device.
Let me get another caller on. That's Scott from Palo Alto. Welcome. You're on the air.
Good morning. I love this conversation. Carl Jung said something to the effect that in life, one of our objectives is to make the unconscious conscious. And what he's talking about is us unconsciously as individuals. The more we become aware of the things that we're not aware of about ourselves, the wholer the person we become. So these devices that are kind of exploding now, we do all of these things. We do a lot of conscious things with the devices, whether it's Google Glass or your mobile phone or whatever it is. But we rarely use them to reflect back. They can constantly track our unconscious patterns of behavior and habits and tendencies. And one day we're going to start using them to reflect back what we've been doing during the day that we've not been aware of. And at the end of the day, we reflect back on all of these things, and we just become more aware of ourselves as people. Kind of a real basic example is if you were one who kind of excessively took selfies just unconsciously, and at the end of the day, your Google Glass or your phone gave you a feedback and said, "Hey, did you know that you took 68 selfies today? It's neither good nor bad, but it's just information that you were not aware of. I look forward to that as a consideration of what I would call artificial intelligence, expanding our intelligence by making ourselves aware of what we're not aware of about ourselves instead of worrying about what others think about us, what the data that they're collecting or whatnot.
That's a good sanguine view, Scott, although someone was opining recently that you could use Google Glass essentially to see yourself in the act of making love, which seems to me maybe a the epitome of narcissism, I suppose, on some level, maybe even another form of creepiness. But I thank you for the call. I'm looking at some more emails here. Several listeners have asked this type of question. No one's talking about the health effects. What might the health effects be from wearing a wireless device near your brain all the time? Any light you can shed on that, Matt Honan?
I can't shed any light on that. Let's be honest. I don't know. I mean, it's got a Bluetooth and a Wi-Fi antenna in there. I'll just be honest. I don't know what the effects of that are.
Well, we don't even know what cell phones at this point. I mean, it remains moot to some degree, although there are strong positions either way because we've done programs on it. But let me go back to Professor Starner. We got a tweet from a listener named Will who says, Michael, can you ask the ProGlass professor precisely what compensation he's getting from Google? Seems important.
My compensation is that I've been seeing the stuff that I've been making for the past 20 years come to life. I'm actually being able to share what I've discovered and what my team's discovered in our living laboratories of living with these devices on a database basis for years, and seeing that, you know, all this, you know, things like navigation, SMS, and email, these things are everybody loves them in their cell phones, but they're being taken out of the world. With Glass, we're putting people back into the world. And that, to tell you the truth, that's the real compensation I'm getting. I'm getting all the stuff out of the lab and into the real world to see how people use it.
So Sergey's not sending you a check every month? Or?
Well, so I do work with Glass. I do get compensation from Glass. It's about on the range of my academic salary. I have 20%. You know, I could do my 20% with Google, and that's what I'm currently doing.
Okay. Thank you for that. Then Jerry writes, Well, actually, let me read a couple of online comments. This is from a listener who says, Google Glass is a great concept, but it is missing the solving my problem component. I was invited to get Google Glass a year ago, and I passed because it doesn't fit in my lifestyle. It doesn't solve any of my immediate problems or meeting my needs. It's probably best used by tourists, similar to the Segway, but as an everyday tool, I don't see it being a part of people's lives. And here's Jerry who says, what about the rudeness factor? And let me go to you on this, Robert Gell. Jerry goes on to say, people today already use smartphones as an extra appendage, only half interested in the person they're speaking to. Glass will only intensify this lack of attention to the person in front of them. Do you agree with that?
Well, it sounds like from Dad's research that that's not necessarily the case, that this can get the eyes back out into the world. And that does sound like a positive aspect of Glass for sure. Because I have been in the situations, I know them very well, I actually don't have a smartphone for many reasons. And I've been in the situation where you're sitting at a table and everyone's got their head down, and I would welcome a situation where everyone's got their head up. I do know that that eye contact and being there in person, that's far more valuable than having your head down for sure.
Bring another caller on, and this is you. Anne, good morning.
Hello, hi. I just have an issue regarding Glass because it is just an extension of us looking out into the world to define ourselves rather than looking in. Because the thing about Facebook and Twitter and all that, it's a lot of projection outside, and Glass is just another way of doing that. So we're always looking outside to determine who we are rather than looking inward, and it's cheaper to go with Zen Buddhism meditation than Glass to determine who we are.
Well, it's interesting in light of that previous comment we had about more introspection and Jung and all of that. Matt Honan, some thoughts about going in, going out. Where are we going here?
I mean, I do think that's a valid point. I think that Glass plays into this notion that we have where we're documenting everything all the time. I mean, that's one of the things that I think people do find most useful about Glass is the camera. But, you know, it also does make it, if you wanted to use it for something like taking simple notes about your day that you wanted to review later, it is a lot easier to say, you know, to say something to Glass and speak a command to Glass that you could take down as a note than it is to even whip out a journal and write that down. So, you know, I don't think that necessarily it's going to make you a worse, less self-aware person just by wearing it.
Again, Matt Honan here in studio, senior writer for Wired, who wrote a piece for Wired on his own experiences wearing Glass. And we'll bring in another caller. Lynn, that's you. Hi, Lynn.
Hi there. Thank you so much. In dovetail to what the last caller said, looking out versus looking in, I think it's really powerful. But also, many things that we have in our lives, gambling, drugs, alcohol, anything can become an addiction, pornography. And it's really dependent on how conscious we are of what we use and how we use it. And I think any new technology, just like Einstein said, I developed a bomb, but I don't think we're ready for that. And are we ready for all this new technology that gets thrown at us so quickly? I'll take my comment off the air. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you for the call.
I love that comment. So for me, it's been very painful to watch people lose themselves in their smartphones as opposed to actually living their lives. One of the things I'm trying to do with Glass and one of the things we're trying to do with wearable computing is get people's attention back on the real world, make it so the technology gets out of the way. One of the ironies of this technology is the closer you bring it to the body, the more liberating it is, the more it gets out of the way. Just like opera glasses on a stick, it's very awkward to use them. You're very conscious of them. But as soon as you put the lenses in a pair of eyeglasses, you just start using them as part of your daily life. And that's the sort of things we want to do with Glass. We want to actually have you use technology less because you're using it more efficiently. And so, you know, I really believe that by experimenting with these different form factors, by trying different things, we can really see if what we're currently doing with computers is actually the right thing to do. Glass provides a different way to use computers than we've ever seen before.
Robert Gill, want to weigh in on this?
Well, I think we have to ask the question of power in this situation. I won't keep harping on the fact that all this stuff flows to Google. I want to pose another scenario. What if our employers mandate that we use wearable computers to monitor us even more closely? So employers are already using computers and mobile devices as a means to ensure workers are always on task. There's a growing industry of device surveillance systems like Mass 360. So let's take this to wearables. Imagine your boss literally being able to look through your eyes as you work. Good luck trying to take a break at that time. Good luck goofing off during work. And we all goof off during work. We all need to be disconnected. So wearable by itself is fine, but wearable articulated with power, like power, the employer-employee relationship, the government-citizen relationship, that's what we should be talking about. So one of the things I'm glad about with Glass is that it's making a lot of these issues visible. It's bringing them out. As these technologies get developed, we have debates. We shape them through our debates, and I'm glad we're having this debate about this technology.
Yeah, so am I. I think it's an important conversation, actually. But I wanted to go also to an online comment here from Ben and get Matt Honan's response. I don't know if you know about the technology here, Matt, but Ben says, when will the police have access so they can run a query that uses all the Google Glasses to find someone? Is there some kind of program or signal that theaters, restaurants, or other public spaces can turn on to turn off and disable Google Glasses so that various rights are protected?
I mean, you could use some sort of something that blocked Wi-Fi or Bluetooth to interfere with it. But, you know, the idea that the police are all going to like be able to tap into our Google Glass or whatever that device down the road is. I mean, you know, that's certainly a possibility in some dystopian future. It's not a possibility with the device right now. But again, I think that all these questions are good ones to think about, because I think that my takeaway from Glass after wearing it for a while is that it feels pretty inevitable. Like, it feels like something we're going to be using just in the ways that we may not have recognized the utility of smartphones when we first saw them, especially when you look at, say, like some of the early Windows phones, Windows CE phones or Blackberries that people, or Treos that people, you know, only a small segment of the population use those. But now everybody has them. And I think as Glass gets more refined and things like Glass get more refined, everybody is going to have them. And we need to be thinking about the long-term implications of that.
Well, we are, I hope, and that's part of this conversation. I want to read a remark here online from Kevin, who says, I think there's a generational gap with regard to being connected too much. As a young person who has had access to the Internet since the first grade, I feel uncomfortable when I'm unable to get online. It's not that I must be using the Internet at all times, but I want my loved ones and friends to be able to reach me in the way they want, when they want. I have Glass, and it absolutely relieves my connection anxiety. I know when I'm wanted by someone else, and more importantly, I know when I'm not. Here's another caller, and that's you. Richard, you're on.
Hi, thanks, Michael. Very important conversation, and I just wanted to bring up, I'm involved in a practice which uses eye contact for connection. And one of the things that I could bring, and I don't know about Google Glass, I'm only supposing, I was actually going to leave your conversation alone until the gentleman started to talk about how he could still stay engaged when wearing Google Glass, and that people looking down at their smartphones, he's just making the delineation between connected and not connected to people around you. And I'm aware of there being more than one kind of eye contact, which is what I'm concerned about with this idea that we think by wearing this in front of us and being able to point our face and our eyes at someone that we are connected to them. And I'm disturbed by the whole use of the word connected, because there is connected and then there's true connection. And those are chasms and miles between those two suffixes to those words. I would like the gentleman to comment, please, on his understanding of what that is. And like I said, I haven't worn them. I don't know what they're like, but I'm a little bit concerned about
it. I understand your concern. Let me actually go to Robert Gell, because he's in communications. So you want to make some reflections on the difference between connection and connecting?
Well, I think the place that we're seeing that play out is this discussion about distracted driving. I know that's not quite exactly answering the caller's question, but the idea of what are you paying attention to, what are your eyes looking at, and if you have a layer of, like, a heads-up display over your field of vision, what does that do? And I think there's a lot of research going on in this area. I know here at the University of Utah there's a distracted driving lab, and they're finding that these devices do, in fact, impair your driving. And so does that tell us something about face-to-face interaction, where you could be looking at somebody but not looking at them, as the caller implies? And I think we have to look into that.
All right, let me get a final word from you on this, Thad Steiner. We've got seconds left.
Well, one of the things about glasses is high in your field of vision, like where your rearview mirror is for your car. You glance up at it, and you get back to what you're doing. Glasses actually higher than your rearview mirror in the car. It's actually in the roof of your car. It stays out of your way. It's easy to ignore. When you're talking with somebody face-to-face, you can see both their eyes, and when you actually need some information, you can say, let me look that up. Okay, Glass, Google something, and you're right back to the conversation.
Okay,
that's
we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you, Thad Steiner. Thank you, Robert Gell. Thank you, Matt Honan. Another hour ahead, we're going to talk about the Grapes of Wrath, 75 years old today. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.